Accession number 10128, Reel 2.
Reel 2.
Well, as the British Army withdrew behind the Dunkirk perimeter, the air component squadrons were gradually being pulled out back to UK because they were in no position to continue the fight. And from then on, the defence of Dunkirk was carried out from home-based squadrons. They flew out from the airfields in Kent and Sussex and around north of London to carry out patrols over Dunkirk. And again, when they sighted the enemy, a combat would cover 20 or 30 miles. And if it actually started overhead the beachhead, which would be unlikely, it was likely to end well out of sight of any of the people on the ground. So that the army will have seldom seen these actual combats going on. When they all came back and they said, where was the air force at Dunkirk? I think this was a natural reaction from people who'd had an extremely tough and arduous time and had seen lots of the enemy dive bombing them, because that was the air operation which they would see. If you're the target, you're going to look up and see the airplanes coming down on you. But what you don't see is the defensive actions going on before the enemy reached the target area, or when you're chasing the enemy away from the target area.
So far we've been talking solely in terms of the RAF against the Luftwaffe, but what part did you personally notice, if any, the French Air Force taking?
We saw, before the main battle started on May the 10th, we occasionally saw French colleagues in Caudron squadrons stationed nearby. We exchanged visits to their messes, we enjoyed their company, and we thought highly of them. When the air fighting began, I think all of us were surprised to find that we didn't see the French in the air. This could have been entirely because of the sectors they were operating over not being the same as ours. At the same time, I think we all expected to see some sort of overlap. And in the 10 days of fighting from May the 10th to May the 20th, I never saw a French Air Force aeroplane in the air. I went on the ground one day, I saw... Potez 63, twin-engined, twin-finned reconnaissance bomber flying at low level across our airfield at Lille. But that was the only example I saw of the French Air Force at that time. I've no doubt they distinguished themselves in the actions that they put up. But I think, and I've subsequently met a number of very courageous and very skillful French Air Force pilots who came over and continued the fight with us in the Royal Air Force subsequently in the war. But I think all of us were surprised to see so very little French Air Force activity.
Did you have much contact with French civilians?
No, hardly at all. Hardly at all. We lived on our own bases, we were our own communities. We didn't rely on the French communities in any way. On the only occasion that I ever visited a French private house, the French were very, very warm and welcoming.
You never had any sense of hostility from French people?
No hostility. Well, we were there, rather indifference. We were in Lille, if you remember, and Lille in 1939 was only just over 20 years since it had last been occupied by the enemy. And I think that there was a great deal of apprehension that this was going to happen again, and maybe the local people felt that the British were either not going to help them or may even have been the cause of the current hostilities. There was a neutral atmosphere there. The only hostility I ever came across was, again, absolutely understandable. On or about May the 17th, 18th, when the fronts were collapsing all round, our forces were pulling back through Belgium. Our airfield was evacuated at Lille, and we took our aeroplanes down to Merville as a first stage withdrawal. I came down the road with the rear party, with two lorries and a staff car, and we became involved in a great mass of refugees, all pouring westwards, blocking the roads, pushing perambulators, bicycles loaded up with blankets and pots and pans, people in cars as long as they could get petrol. This was one of the refugee columns that may well have been strafed, as they all were, before we saw them. And as we tried to get through them in clearly marked RAF vehicles, there was a great deal of hostility. I think they felt that here were the British running away or something, which we weren't actually doing, but that's what they thought.
How did you respond?
Well, there wasn't any way you could respond, really, by just pressing on and hoping to get through, which we did.
You just ignored it, did you?
Yes.
You've talked about dogfights over France, but was there any strafing of German army positions?
Later in the week, for the first 4 or 5 days, we were entirely involved in intercept patrols, take off, climb, circle and wait, or make deeper penetrations down towards the area of ground battle. Second half of the week, we started to get orders to take alternative targets of opportunity, which meant columns of troops and vehicles that could be positively identified as hostile. And that meant ground attacks with machine guns, which weren't a particularly effective weapon on vehicles. They were on troops, of course, coming up those long, straight roads lined by poplar trees in the area of Arras and later on Lille, and then down towards Aberville on the Somme. Those were areas that we frequently did ground attack work.
Lots of people I've interviewed about this period talk about German aircraft attacks on columns of civilians on the roads, yeah. Refugees.
Yeah.
Do you think that those attacks were deliberate, or could they have been accidental from your...
No, absolutely deliberate. It was part of a tactical policy to jam the roads and prevent the Allied armed forces using those roads primarily to reinforce their front. If you jam the roads with refugees, with overturned vehicles and slaughtered horses and so on, reserves were going to take longer to get up to the front, done deliberately, particularly when the columns of refugees were going into villages and towns with crossroads. They blocked the whole thing so that nobody could get through the village.
As far as the battle between the RAF and the Luftwaffe was concerned over France, do you think it was fought in a spirit of fair play, or were there any underhand tactics that were employed by either side?
I wasn't aware of anything other than just straightforward battle. We were trained as fighter pilots to attack the enemy in any form that we met him, and we attacked him, and he attacked us, and one started to hear about the enemy shooting at pilots on parachutes. I never actually came across that directly, so I couldn't comment on it. I'm damn sure our people didn't do that. You have to have a certain attitude of mind for that, and I don't believe that any of our people had that sort of attitude of mind.
What kind of attitude of mind do you think you would have to have?
Well, it's some form of of killer instinct, isn't it? I mean, I think that the average fighter pilot in the squadrons in those days was doing the job he was trained to do, which was basically defending his country. When it came down to cases, aeroplanes met in the air with black crosses on them, either were full of bombs or guns, which were going to be aimed at you or your colleagues and your family and so on the ground. And so you went after them and you destroyed them. But if they jumped out on a parachute, well, that was their good luck and that was it. It never occurred to you to get after them in those conditions.
How did you come to leave France?
May the 20th at Merville, the base we'd withdrawn to. I came down to the airfield after sleeping the second half of the night in a commandeered house in the village of Merville. There was no organisation, of course, by then. Nobody woke me, so I overslept a bit, and I walked down the road to where I believed the remainder of my squadron to be parked, and I arrived there, I suppose, about an hour after dawn to find that the first operation had already taken place, and we only had four or five Hurricanes left. One of our remaining ones was standing up on its nose in the middle of the field where it had been tipped up on landing by my old friend Dennis David, who's still well and around today. And I reported to the squadron commander, and he said, well, you're on the next show, B. If there's an aeroplane for you. And about 5 minutes later, he called myself and a chap I mentioned before, John Cockover, and he said, look, we've only got four serviceable aeroplanes, and there are more pilots, as you know. You and John, pointing to me, can spin a coin for who's taking that one. And he spun the coin. John got called, and he won the toss, and so he took the next flight. Well, nothing happened until about midday, and then there was a raid in which some high-altitude bombing took place. We couldn't see where they came from, but they dropped a stick of bombs across the far side of the aerodrome, which was really rather noisy. And we all wondered what was going to happen next, and then the CO came over and he said the readiness section, that's the people who've been allotted the remaining aeroplanes, will fly back to Debden this afternoon, and the rest of you fellas, hopefully there's a Douglas airliner coming in at midday or thereabouts, you can get on that and it'll take you back home. And I was flown back to Hendon in a DC-2 of KLM, complete with fully uniformed crew, at about 1 o'clock that day, in skies that were absolutely full of enemy aeroplanes. We had no escort, so it was really quite an exciting flight. And we were totally full of wounded pilots. I was about the only chap who wasn't wounded on the aeroplane. The rest, it was an evacuation of wounded.
Now, back in Britain, what kind of preparations did you personally make before the Battle of Britain actually started up?
Well, on arriving at Hendon, I was given a weekend pass and told to report to Debden after 24 hours. When at home, a telegram arrived telling me to report to Duxford on the following day. And there I found the remnants of the squadron forming. A few of our Hurricanes only had been brought up from Debden. The remaining pilots, about half our original complement. The ground crews hadn't really yet appeared because they were somewhere between France and the UK. And some of us wondered whether they'd been lost in the Lancastria, but of course they hadn't. They'd come across on a ferry, I think, from Calais or somewhere. And they started coming in dribs and drabs over the next week. Over a period of 10 days, we were re-equipped with new Hurricanes. We ferried our remaining old ones down to Biggin Hill, where they were used by a squadron that was already in action over Dunkirk. And by the end of June, we'd worked up new pilots, got ourselves back into full flying drill, and we started night operations in defence of Hull from Did I say Duxford?
Yes.
Can you erase that on the tape? It should have been Church Fenton. Church Fenton. And we started night operations over Church Fenton against single enemy reconnaissance aeroplanes that were coming in. They were unsuccessful. And then on the 1st or 2nd of July, the squadron moved down to Exeter in 10 Group and was declared operational once again. During July, the attacks started by the Luftwaffe over the channel, particularly against the convoys, were happening all around our area, particularly in the area of Portland and Southampton, Weymouth, and of course occasionally down at Plymouth, and our squadron got involved in all those. And then we wondered whether we were going to be moved up into the metropolitan sector, but because we were being kept so busy by regular big raids in the southwest, in fact they kept us there, and 87 flew throughout the Battle of Britain from Exeter, covering major raids on Portland and Southampton, and backing up Tangmere for the Portsmouth raids. And we also were involved in the two big major raids over Bristol. And we had a very busy 3 months, but in fact it wasn't the same sort of activity that the places like Tangmere, Biggin Hill, Kennedy and so on had, because the intensity of the battle was not so great. Squadrons involved in the London area in August were often on three or more sorties a day. We at the most would have two sorties a day down in the west, and sometimes only one, but we were getting one major battle about every two or three days. And they were a great experience, because there weren't too many squadrons down in the west. There was two squadrons at Exeter and one squadron at Warmwell. And so our major battles were generally fought in that area, with at the most three squadrons of Hurricanes and one squadron of Spitfires. And you would not know that the other squadrons were there. You would be scrambled with 9, 10 or 12 Hurricanes, and you would go off on a typical example, for instance, was August the 15th, when my squadron was scrambled about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. To intercept what was described by the controller as 100 plus heading north from Cherbourg, and we were vectored to Portland, and we climbed out to Portland as quickly as we could. And as we started heading out south over Weymouth at about 15,000 feet, the controller was saying, your 100 plus is now 150 plus, 20 miles south of Portland Bill, heading northeast. And we thought, right, well, they're just going to go up over Portland Bill and then turn left into a dive bombing attack on Portland Harbour, which is exactly what they did. And we continued on our course, and in fact we had about 9 aeroplanes that day, and we were pulling our harness straps tight and turning on the gun sight and getting, you know, all the sort of anticipatory moves necessary. And then the controller said, bandits now 20 miles ahead of you, you should see them directly ahead. And almost immediately the clear sky ahead started to turn into a mass of little black dots. It was really, can only be described really as a beehive. We used to call them the beehive. And this mass of black dots appeared developing ahead, and our CO continues to lead us straight towards it. And I just had time to think, well, I wonder what sort of tactic he's going to employ. Is he going to turn up sun and try and dive out of the sun at them, or go round to the right and come in behind? What's he going to do? And while I thought that, it was quite apparent he wasn't going to do anything. He bored straight on into the middle of this lot until we seemed to be going straight into the biggest formation of aeroplanes you ever saw. And then his voice came on the radio and he said, target ahead, come on chaps, let's surround them. There are just 9 of us.
Can you describe what happened subsequently?
Oh yes, we went right into the middle, and each of us took, by that time you see, we were no longer as inexperienced as we had been in France, and I suppose that many of us were now getting quite overconfident. We thought we were real fully trained fighter pilots. and so there was less apprehension, there was more concentration of picking out a target. And out of this great mass ahead, you would have two things to do. First thing would be to watch your immediate leader and make sure you didn't run into him, and that you hadn't selected the same target as he had. In other words, if he was directly ahead of you, there was no good trying to fire at his target, because you might hit him, and that wasn't regarded as a good thing to do. You picked your own target, went in on a firing pass, and then with all this great mass of aeroplanes around, the next high priority was to avoid a collision, because you would be diving into a mass formation. They, in their turn, would start breaking formation under fire, and the whole place would be a mass of aeroplanes going in all directions. And so you have to fire at a target and then try to evade anything that's in your way. And I fired at a Ju-87, point-blank range, and I hit it. I don't know what happened to it. I could see my tracers going into it. Rolled away from it as I went by it, because I was going much faster than the 87, Ju-87 Stuka. While I did that, I became under attack from directly ahead and below, and it turned out to be ME-110 doing a zoom climb straight up at me, firing as he came. He missed me, and I rolled away from him straight behind another of his mates, 110. And I fired a long burst at him, and his port engine stopped and started to stream smoke and fire. I pulled away from that, and there seemed to be a lot of activity immediately behind my tail at that time, so I went into a very tight turn, and a diving turn, dived out of it until I seemed to be free of all the other aeroplanes, levelled out, climbed back up, and as happened in that sort of confused fight, there were no sign of any hurricanes. I could see a formation of aeroplanes in the distance, which were probably the rest of the enemy heading off back across the channel, and two or three streaks of smoke going down the sky where there were fires from a burning aircraft. And immediately below, I was over Lyme Bay to the just south of Abbotsbury Swanery. And I could see great boils in the water where either aircraft or bombs had gone in. I didn't know what they were. And then there was nothing else to do but go home, because I was out of touch with everything, and I'd used most of my ammunition, so I throttled back and opened the canopy, cooled down a bit, and flew off back home. And the squadron that day lost one of our number, killed, one shot down who came back to us, and the CO was one of the chaps who didn't come back. And our claims were 9 destroyed and 4 probables. Now, whether they were confirmed or not, I couldn't say, but that was the sort of level of an intensity of the fighting on that particular day.
Do any other days stick out in your mind from the Battle of Britain?
Yes, I can give you another one very soon after that. Sorry. A few days later, we were scrambled on another of these major raids, and we were vectored after a plot that was coming in over the Isle of Purbeck. A brilliant sunny afternoon again, and we saw them coming in roughly over Swanage, a great line of twin-engine bombers, Dorniers in the front, Ju-88s behind, probably around about 70 or 80 of them, with obviously a fighter escort which we couldn't see. And this time we had plenty of time to position ourselves, and as the bomber formation swung round, obviously aiming once again from Weymouth, coming down in a turn from the northwest to Portland, our squadron commander took us in for a beam attack, diving from about 5,000 feet above them. And by that time, we were beginning to get some tactical experience, and I'd realised, that the wrong thing to do in these major battles was to stick in there, milling around in the middle of all the confused fighting. But the thing to do was to make a firing pass on your selected target, and then dive out of it, take stock of the situation, and then get stuck in at something else. And I did just that, and I did a long straight firing pass at a Dornier, right into point blank range and hit it well, and it streamed smoke and rolled out of the formation. And I rolled away from it, straight down into a spiral dive, pulled out about 5,000 feet lower down, looked round, cleared my tail. There was nobody there. I could see the rest of this formation still up above. And I thought, right, well, I'll climb back up and see if I can pick up a straggler. But before I did that, a target presented itself, because right down across my front came a single ME-109. And by this time we were in the just over the Isle of Purbeck, in the area of Warmwell Airfield. I remember seeing it down on my right. And I rolled in after this Messerschmitt, half thinking for a moment it might be a Spitfire, because it was so unusual to see a single Messerschmitt by itself. And either whether he'd been hit or not, I don't know. He wasn't showing any smoke. He was travelling fairly fast, just diving towards the sea as if he was getting the hell out of it and going home, which is probably just what he was doing. Anyway, I got onto his tail, fired a long burst, and he slowed up, and then he rolled very violently up to the right. As he came out of his roll, I was back on his tail, close in for another burst, when I could see that his undercarriage was coming down, and he was also streaming grey smoke, might have been coolant. We were down to about 1,200 feet then, over the fields of Dorset, the Purbeck Hills, and he started to sideslip fairly violently. And he did another roll, this time with his wheels down, and then did a diving turn down towards the ground. And I thought, well, either he's going to go in, or he's actually aiming for a forced landing. And I held off, and he went round a field, lost speed, sideslipped quite sharply. And he was obviously a very capable pilot. And eventually he went in to land on this field rather hard, buckled the undercarriage, slid on his belly across the field, and ended up at the far end in a hedge. And I dived round after him, and I saw him lift his canopy, the sideways opening cockpit of the 109, jump out of the wing, and then lie flat on the ground. And I wonder whether he thought his aeroplane was going to blow up. And then I realised that he must have thought I was going to strafe him on the ground, which wasn't a thing that it would have occurred to me to do. But anyway, I flew round again, and this time he was on his feet and back up on the wing route, diving into the cockpit. And whether he was putting his maps or something in or not, I don't know, but it was then smoking, and it was soon after that caught fire properly. And subsequently the army unit who took charge of him, he spoke to them, and he said that he was appreciative of the pilot who shot him down, not strafing him on the ground, and he asked these army chaps to give me his Luger pistol, which they duly did.
Have you still got it?
No, I had to hand it in under the firearms amnesty.
Any other days that you can recount? Which day was that, by the way?
Well, without looking at my logbook, I couldn't tell you. I think it was probably around about the 28th of August. There was another fascinating occasion of quite a different sort. One more early morning in that month, I was the readiness section, and we were scrambled, three of us, to intercept a bandit in the Severn Estuary area. This was unusual for us, because we normally were heading down and south over the channel. This time we climbed north up towards Stark Point in the early morning light, lovely early summer morning. And we climbed out over Lundy Isle, and the radio was giving us continuous plots of a bandit coming south from roughly from the Swansea area, crossing our front.